currently stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire, Maryland's 5/8 mile training track, completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning. Learn more at CountryLifeFarm.com.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at Parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd, PA Day for Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series, yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Can you hear them talking about us, telling lies? Is that a surprise? Can you see them, see right through them? They have a shield, nothing must be revealed. It doesn't matter what they say. No one listens.
Good to get a little ATR music back into play. We're going to try to work our music back in and work in Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale Inn and Sid Fernando standing by. Good morning. There we go. I didn't hear you. Now I got you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can. I had you. It was my fault. I had the wrong speaker on. Sid, we got a huge weekend ahead and some very interesting, you know, potentials in these Derby preps. But there's one theme you've got to touch on for a second. Here were some results from the weekend where White of Barry Oak wins the Florida Derby. He's by Race Day, who's in Korea. Ugiri, she wins the Fantasy. She's by Shackleford. He's in Korea. it's a little bit of a hassle to send your mare to Korea to get covered.
Yeah, and, you know, it's also the theme of not only, you know, usually a horse starts going to Korea when they're kind of off the boil here, meaning they're standing for a lower stud fee, and it's not commercially feasible either because you're not getting enough mares, or the stud fee with the number of mares you're getting is just not profitable. So you've got those two horses, race day, Son of Tappet was, you know, standing fairly inexpensively, and essentially what you have, Steve, is you've got great examples of lower stud fee horses. That's the only way to say it, because if you take in Kathleen Ho, her sire, Upstart, was standing for 10,000. And so, you know, it's, again, a theme we've talked about before, that when you get exported, you seem to have a lot of success. That's one. And B, some of these lower fee horses are viable horses. And, you know, not just in the stud fee. Kathleen Ho, for example, was an $8,000 yearling, or a weanling. I'm not sure which one.
Not only her, you know, to touch on Ugiri for a second, we had the conversation with Rudy Brissett, and Rudy's had that Western River, the maiden winner, that's a full brother of Creator that they bought for $30,000.
Yeah,
I mean, people should be very encouraged. I mean, not trying to hold prices down, but there really is on a weekly basis, looking at these groups of results, encouraging, you know, messages essentially for people that, you know, that don't have big budgets.
You can fold in Hit of the Bomb, the sire of
Tisdom. Yeah.
Hit of the Bomb stands for 5,000.
That's right.
He's the son of Warfriend, who's a G1 winner.
Yeah. And Kenny, we talked about Tis the Bomb with Ken McPeak on Monday, and he actually was a standout physical, and Kenny, you know, one of the people that, you know, talks about buying individuals and buying on the physical. Seth Klarman and Chad Brown pick out horses with obscure pedigrees and are, you know, quick to pay top dollar for offbeat pages, based on the individual. But, it's still notable that, you know, if you're breeding to race, for instance, it's encouraging to know that you can pay $5,500, $10,000 and end up with a stake horse yourself.
Well, conversely, it's also incredible that you can, breed a Tis the Bomb from a $5,000 stud fee, and you know, you've got a $330,000 yearling.
Yeah. So if you're commercial, that's right. There you go. Yeah. There you go. It's encouraging to know that that there's people out there that if you raise a good horse and a horse that impresses. It's funny, in the case of that Western River, for instance, with Rudy Brissett, I guess his wife picked that colt out, and happened to be a May foal, and was just immature, didn't have the physical properties. So it takes somebody with some savvy and some ability to project how a horse that hasn't had, you know, the growth spurts necessary to make it imposing, you got to speculate. I mean, Creator became a good sized bruising, you know, Tappet. This one, was behind, and that this is a horse with huge upside. That I mean, how does that? How does the half? Not a half. How does a full to a classic winner get away for $30,000?
Well, you have to look at this even in a under a different microscope, which is how does the son of Tappet get away for $30,000?
Yeah.
And really, when you're looking at a horse like this, let's be realistic about it. The horse had to have had a bunch of issues and or confirmation issues and or breathing or veterinary issues that obviously prohibited other people from pursuing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rudy Brissett himself bought this one for $30,000. And, you know, you've got to give it to him because he whatever he found in it, and we're never going to know whether it's really bad x-rays or this horse really is not a good-looking horse or it's got a bad wind, whatever it is, it didn't affect this horse, which is another element to this game, too. You know, sometimes... you know, veterinary reports go by the wayside.
Focus on Kathleen O for a second too, and I think we've touched on her. You know, as she continues to, you know, to succeed. I think we brought her up after the Devona Dale, but upstart, son of Flatter, and out of a Blame mare. Herself out of Tail of the Cat mare, going back further, Pretty and Smart, the Beau Genius, Third Dam, and even a Vice Regent. So there's, you know, there's Canadian blood in here, top Canadian families. Then, you know, certainly Blame is regarded as a broodmare sire in and of itself. Upstart, the only part about this that's sad is that Rick Violette can't be around to see Upstart, you know, get a horse like this and succeed. That's at stud.
And we spoke about Upstart, you know, over the last couple of weeks. I remember distinctly having this conversation about, you know, the fact that he's at Airdrie, the son of Flatter. You know, it's interesting because Kathleen O was bred by Gainsway in partnership with
Malone.
Rival Farm.
Yeah.
John Malone. Okay. And if you look at this, Gainsway, who was the consigner, let this filly go for $8,000 at the Keeneland November sale. By the way, Gainsway was also the consigner of the full to Creator that got sold for $30,000. Just a little aside there. But anyway, Kathleen O, speaking of this whole, you know, idea that, you know, there could be something veterinary or whatever, $8,000 was less than the stud fee, something obviously was awry for Gainsway and Bridalwood Farm to let this weanling just go. I would assume maybe a combination of maybe size or some physical issues. I don't know what it was, but it's interesting the progression because she was purchased for $8,000 as a weanling. The Pinhook, she got Pinhooked at OBS October as a yearling for $50,000. Okay, so that was a really nice return on investment, that $8,000 into $50,000. But here's the good one: she then was Pinhooked as a yearling into a 2-year-old for $275,000. Shug McGahey was obviously the buyer. We've talked about that story about how, yada, you know, yada, yada, yada. But what's interesting is the consigner at OBS April was Niall Brennan. And Niall Brennan is the person that is now breaking the Phipps yearlings in Florida. So I'm sure Shug on visits to Niall's place to oversee how the Phipps yearlings were turning into two-year-olds and how they were coming along. I'm sure he noticed Kathleen O at this point. I'm sure Niall told him this filly is, you know, something else. She made 275. Shug got her, and, you know, the rest is history right now. So an 8,000 weanling to 275,000 two-year-old by a sire now that's pretty hot. Airdrie now, at this point in time in the breeding season, has actually changed the stud fee from 10,000 to private, which means it's higher. And there's demand. So, you know, it's amazing how this business works. Don't forget, Upstart only has really two crops racing, even though he's third. He's got three. The third crop is two-year-olds really haven't had a chance to race yet. So he's got two crops at the races, and he's really got a very, very nice filly here that most people who saw the race thought she was really the star of the day, you know, trained by the right guy. And Zandon, the other another good three-year-old, don't forget he was only beaten in that controversial Remsen by Mo Donegal, photo finish. So he's got two very legitimate three-year-olds too, so it really boosts his stock. And he's the son of Flatter, and you know, it's again a $10,000 stallion. So it began as one, or was one. So you know, it really just shows you how this game can it's not exclusively a millionaire's game. And it's ironic that this mare was bred by two, you know, millionaires, billionaires, whatever, in Gainesway and Bridlewood.
You know, in addition, and because you mentioned Zandon and Kathleen O, Upstart also got Mask Parade in that first crop. Yeah,
exactly.
And their reinvestment risk was him as well. So in the first crop. So how often, Sid, do we see this? An in-season switch to a private fee?
It's, you know, when you start to get hot, it'll happen.
Huh.
And it's not common. But once the demand starts coming in, you know, you saw this stuff happening either last year or the year before with Munnings. Munnings, you know, started off at a certain fee, started going up actually as the season went forward. And then it was private, and seasons were selling multiples of what he had even started off at the beginning of the season. So
interesting.
Yeah, it's always a you know, it's always a good barometer of what's taking place in terms of perception of a stallion.
I should also note that even though it wasn't one was a maiden winner and the other was an older horse, it was a good weekend for Airdrie, because you had those Creative Cause winners at Turfway. King Cause was the Kentucky Cup Classic winner, and Paulo Lobo had that My Buddy B that I brought up with Brad Cox, because he had Blue Devil run second in that opener at Turfway, and Creative Cause with a couple of notable performers on Saturday,
yeah,
as well. So good weekend for Airdrie.
Yeah, and American Freedom had that winner too. So, yeah, very, very good.
Nice.
Weekend for Airdrie, highlighted, of course, by Kathleen O.
Got to at least pay homage to our friend Al Gold and Cyberknife. Al joined us on Monday, which we really were looking forward to. Al said he wasn't coming on the show again until he won a grade one, and 3 weeks later he won a grade one. So, you know, Gunrunner, obviously, Sid, is just going from strength to strength, and he's, you know, he's creating a vapor trail that is really quite, you know, quite notable what's happening here with him.
Yeah. I mean, he, you know, this is yet another grade one winner, obviously, from his first crop, giving him three, with Cyberknife, the third, following Echo Zulu, and was also a champion, obviously.
Yeah.
And Gunite, who won the hopeful G1. Of course, you got Papa Cap, G2 winner. I mean, you know, it's just crazy the numbers he's throwing up.
This, and I'm just looking to pull Cyberknife's page up here, and I'm having trouble, actually.
Good stakes winning dam by Flower Alley. And the next dam is the half-sister Well Armed.
Oh yeah, well that's that's the family of Mr. Hot Stuff, and right, that's that dam. What is her name? That had...
the dam of Well Dressed.
Well Dressed, thank you.
It's also the family of Mr. Money, who's at stud, and. American Patriot, Warfront G1 winner, as well as the Warfront horse Bombard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He, you know, I said this to, I don't know if you heard Al on the show, but.
No, I missed it.
Well, it was a lot of fun, but I did ask him, and he acknowledged. Cyberknife is a four-generation outcross, Sid, and I imagine the clamoring for him between now and Derby for somebody to, you know, get breeding rights to him will be cacophonous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got a horse that's going into... This is... Between now and the Derby are when prices just go through the roof. They absolutely go through the roof. And by the way, this colt was a $400,000 Euro.
Yeah.
Bred by the Ramseys.
Yeah, and Al acknowledged, I mean, we weren't going to get into the specifics, but he acknowledged that the phone is already rung. And... You know, to me, what was remarkable, it felt like, you know, there was potential because there was the sibling of Luke's Alley ran this weekend in a maiden race. But here, you know, here's a dam by Flower Alley. It seemed with, you know, with Gene Melnick passing last week, there was potential for a, you know, for a storyline. It seems like that happens, you know, pretty regularly.
Yeah, exactly.
Has he been? What's his? He's been around long enough, obviously. Flower Alley. Does he have a broodmare sire reputation yet?
I think he's the broodmare sire of, you know, quite a number of over 20, maybe 25 black type winners.
Wow.
Yeah. There.
Sid, that brings up a great question for people that take an interest in this. Where do you go for reports, Equine Line, for that kind of statistic support when you put together the broodmare compatibility analysis and you cite those kinds of stats, where do they come from? What are your resource guides?
Well, you know, we pay the Jockey Club equine line because they're the obvious official compiler of stats. So we get stats from them. Then we also have our own individual stats in the sense that I worked there with consultants. We filter some stats even more because we don't look at restricted states winners because we're trying to make it a higher quality group of black type winners we look at when we calculate, for example, our NICs and so forth. But you can get all this information, right from Equine Line.
Right. When I cite families and such, I strictly am using American Produce Record.
Yeah,
which is great. I mean, it's a quick and it goes back into the. '60s, and so it's helpful, and it's got state records, it's got the other Briz numbers like average winning distance, and provides the sales stats as well. But I know that when you look at the serious statistics and having that you've prepared broodmare compatibility for me, there's a next level set of stats, obviously, that you're quoting from. So that's where where it's coming.
Yeah.
Well, we're on the doorstep here, Sid, and we got some, I think, really intriguing races that'll make some, make the Derby field firm up, and Messier and Forbidden Kingdom. Together in California, New York has got at least five serious candidates. Same thing in the Bluegrass, and then you fold in the Ashland and the Gazelle and Santa Anita Oaks. So we've got a big weekend of particularly of sophomore action, and we'll have plenty to digest next week.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely talk about it.
Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill & Dale, and plenty of time. We're just about halfway through breeding season. 510-490-1111. Get a hold of Roger and Sid. They'll help you with your decision. And as you can tell, there's negotiating with the farms that they'll do for you, and maybe get you a bargain, maybe get you into somebody that... they're ahead of the curve, and then of course people are looking at their babies that, starting to take shape, running around. I've seen some funny ones. It's amazing how within days you got foals running around, Sid, in pens with their mom looking on, and they're running like crazy. They're doing circles around these paddocks. They're 4 days old and they're at full speed. It's crazy.
And you're one of those that are enjoying that with foals of your own.
Well, we got the first baby, of course, the Leofric baby, and got to get. In fact, may go down this weekend, maybe on Sunday, to see how the baby will be 10 days old. And Voltarine. And I don't know if this is a pattern, but she again looks like she's going to be very late delivering her Mosler. She was 3 weeks late with her first, with the Motown.
Yeah.
And it looks like they think, she's giving no signs that she's ready to foal. And she's already, it's already just the due date, but she's probably going to be 3 weeks late again.
Wow. Is Voltarine the mare by Archarchard?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, what a great combination that is, Warfront with Arch. I mean, it's just a phenomenal combo for you, and I really think you're going to do well.
Well, we can't wait. And then she's going to go right back down to Country Life like she did last year, and she's going to go to Mosler again, and Country Life, who's raising the Motown baby, they'll raise the Mosler baby as well, and get certified down in the Mid-Atlantic, and try to take advantage of everything that we've got, you know, in the Northeast, and down to Virginia for certification, and you know, there's so many things that can that make it, you know, that can help you.
Yeah, and also something that can help you is that there have been 17 individual Sons of Warfront to date that have sired a Group 1 winner or Grade 1 winner.
Well, your mouth to God's ears. Let's make this first Mosler, and let's get him out healthy, number one, or her. I don't even know. I haven't asked about the scans and you know what's lurking in there, but we had a colt already with the Leofric, so I think a filly would be nice. It'd be nice to get a filly out of Voltairine.
Yeah.
Cuz we're going to try to pretend that we're big time breeders, and we're going to, you know, sell the colts, keep the fillies. That's the plan,
nice.
Right?
Yeah, nice.
Well, listen, if it's good enough for Watts Humphrey, it's good enough for us. Sid, thanks a lot. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, we'll talk to you next week.
You got it.
Thanks again, Steve. Bye.
Sid Fernando, Sire Watch. Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale. And we're going to turn, stay right with it. I knew this was going to be a busy full day, and that's exactly what we've got. Really looking forward to, even though it's a serious conversation and something that, as an industry, we've got to, you know, gird the proverbial loins against a very high, a very difficult foe, essentially, when it comes to PETA and other animal activists. David Fuskus joins us. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, and I know you're going to tell me I shouldn't have to apologize, but I should have had you on this show ages ago.
Well, I'm a big fan. I listen all the time. I was just listening on the way to work today to your interview a couple of days ago with Alan Foreman, and Alan and I disagree on some things, but I respect him greatly and really enjoyed the interview.
Well, David, he's one of our resources when it comes to all kinds of, particularly the legal issues around the game and the challenges.
Yeah, sure.
This conversation is really a reference, a point of reference conversation too, because in your role as a public relations agent, as it were,
right,
and consultant and crisis, crisis manager.
Right.
You've been helping the Jockey Club, and we certainly have had our share of crises,
yeah,
to negotiate.
Well, we started working for the Jockey Club, back in 18 when everything started breaking at Santa Anita, and that kind of morphed into, we did all of the communications work for the Jockey Club on supporting and pushing forward the Horse Racing and Horse Racing Integrity Act. So, we're not working for them right now, but we're good friends and in frequent contact with Jim Gagliano, one of my favorite people.
Let me ask before we get into specifics and what feels,
sure,
what feels like concerted and coordinated effort between some news agencies and PETA in New York. We'll get to that in a second. But from your perspective, how is it that the industry generally has appeared flat-footed when confronted with crisis scenarios?
Well, let's face it. Listen, I've been involved in horse racing for a long time as a fan, as a, you know, occasional horse owner and a number of things. And, you know, let's face it, you know, thoroughbred horse racing is not the most progressive industry out there, right? If you kind of look across, you know, all the industries in the country and in the world and see how many have been really transformed by technology and other things, you know, horse racing is kind of way behind. And the reason I say that is, is it's very difficult for the industry to react quickly to things. The industry does not react quickly to things. Part of that is because, you know, we say the horse racing industry, it's not a monolith, right? It's all these different, yeah. you know, it's all these different organizations. But my experience, you know, thoroughbred horse racing has generally been pretty slow to address issues. And when you get things like attacks from, you know, well-funded animal rights groups, you know, the extreme ones like, you know, PETA, for example, PETA moves very quickly. They're extremely well-funded. They know how to use the media. And they get out and start doing things, and the industry is generally pretty slow to respond.
I could bring up, I suppose, you know, any number of scenarios. You mentioned the breakdown scenario at Santa Anita. If you go back to 2010, we had the spate of fatalities at Aqueduct.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had essentially really underhanded attacks on Steve Asmussen and his barn by PETA, and
absolutely.
With assistance from the New York Times. The New York Times took broadsides at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Similarly, I mean, in each of these cases, then you fold in scenarios like Eight Bells, and in each case, and you would think that over, you know, from let's say 2010 to 2022, that's 12 years, that we would have a more centralized response mechanism that provided a uniform answer to, you know, to basically educate a public that is being, you know, confronted, assaulted with, in a lot of cases, misinformation and propaganda. And as a professional, you know, your operation is Xenophone Strategies. What is the recommendation, David? How do we coalesce around a central voice and response?
Well, the first thing is coordination and working together. That doesn't mean that you know the Jockey Club and the HPPA are gonna merge on this, but some, you know, common ongoing discussions on these things. I think there's things that we can all, you know, everybody can agree on. You know, one thing that brought us together is the program, and I just published an article in the Pollack Report that was looking at Patrick Patello, the guy who runs Horse Racing Wrongs, and a really outrageous, you know, op-ed piece that he put in the Times Union and, you know, in Albany, right? But we know these things are coming because they come and they come up and they go, you know, right now, for example, you know, with PETA, right? And PETA is very well funded, right? Their budget last year was $60 million, right? Unlike Horse Racing Wrongs, their budget last year was $50,000 on this. And PETA has a long track record of going out and beginning campaigns and carrying them through. So when you see things like the Edie Falco, you know, the actress from The Sopranos, her video that she did for, you know, New York legislatures, and the things that they're starting to do now, you know, we can reasonably expect that horse racing is moving up onto one of the issues that PETA is going to be out and using as one of their primary issues, right? And so, you know, getting together with the industry, kind of, you know, coordinating, you know, not so much what we're going to say. You don't tell people what to say, but coordinate the engagement on these things. So when the news media starts covering this stuff, that there's a variety of people who are, you know, up to speed on what's going on and what they're doing and what the messages should be for that, you know, that kind of, you know, even loose coordination would go a long way towards helping with this stuff.
Right? And you bring up the piece that you wrote, which really point by point confronted the, you know, the essentially
Well, with Patrick Vitale, he's been doing this for years. Listen, I'm a communicator. I run a company, and what we do is we help organizations deal with issues. Right? We're not a PR firm trying to get a food writer to write about the new pizza flavor of ketchup. Right? Heinz ketchup. We help companies, you know, deal with things. I've been dealing with this stuff for an awful long time. If you just look at that article he published, you know, it's got all the tricks of propaganda. Propaganda is the only way that you can really describe that. And when you get holders of extremist views here or in, you know, with other industries and other issues, and they're trying to mainstream their, you know, their thoughts, right, what they believe in. One of the ways you do that is you go in and you create emotional responses by going out and saying very emotional things. You infer credibility to yourself by, you know, citing some set of facts or research you're doing, and then you extrapolate all, you know, if you extrapolate off of that. And I'll just give you a quick example. If I'm a group on, you know, an animal rights group, you know, on chicken, for example, and I'm opposed to how we raise chicken in this country. So I might go out and I might look at the various state health departments, right, that are collecting information on salmonella reporting. Then I might publish a report, take all that table and publish it and say, listen, our group, we've gone out and here's the government data on salmonella, right? And then I transition over something completely unrelated. But that's not the real issue here. The real issue here is how these birds are raised and abused. And it comes back to chicken in America. By coming out with that fact at the beginning, right, I'm trying to infer credibility over what I'm saying. This is kind of a well-known, well-used technique for decades to mainstream extremist ideas. And for at least for animal rights groups, the extreme ones, you know, PETA, Horse Racing Law, and others. I'm not talking about the Humane Society or Animal Wellness Action, those groups. But these are just techniques they use, and people buy it. And editors buy it. At newspapers and professional journalists buy it. That article was so flawed. I was amazed that the Times Union even published it, to tell you the truth.
Well, and this series that they have been trotting out. It's one thing to see something like this in a market, where there's potential and uncertainty about the viability, let's say, of an animal based sport or equine activity, etc. This is a marketplace that is driven, that has a economic engine of mammoth proportion in the Capital District.
Absolutely.
It's a bizarre, it's just the fact that they would be interested in buying into this and presenting it in such an underhanded manner. And that goes part and parcel with you mentioned the message that PETA and Edie Falco sent out, which completely misrepresents monies that the industry generates and receives, you know, via the aqueduct VLTs. If you haven't seen this piece, the minute and a half commentary from Falco, where they're trying to establish a set of parameters that are artificial, that they're essentially lying to anybody that's listening.
They're artificial, and like with any good propaganda, right? I mean, there's kernels of truth in there. But what's completely lacking from that piece is the context of the overall issue. If anyone would objectively look at this, there's just no, you know, context there. But let's be clear about what Pete is doing with that, right? If you go to the Facebook page or you go to the YouTube, you watch that video, and in the description section, there's going to be there's a link there. When you click on the link, it takes you over to a page of PETA, which gives you a little bit on their take on the issue. And then there's a great big thing. Sign up. Speak out against horse cruelty, right? you put your information in, you click, you send it in. You've now just given Pete all your information, right? And you've just entered the very large PETA fundraising machine. And you're going to start getting, solicitations for fundraising, you know, almost immediately. You know, it's not unusual. It's more the norm than not for many groups, especially groups that have kind of extremist views, that a key factor in almost everything they do is fundraising. And that's what PETA's doing here. PETA raises a lot of they spend $60 million a year. That's a lot of donations. And it's my personal opinion on this. And we at Xenophon, we work on over the years we worked on a number of issues with companies and PETA, but so we know a lot about them, right? And it's my personal opinion on this that fundraising is one of the key factors for almost every issue that they decide to that they decide to highlight.
Talk about habits and practice and methodology to counteract this successfully, to educate and to win over anybody that has is uncertain about what's truth and what's not.
Yeah, first you got to put the who's saying what into perspective, right? So Petra Petello and horse racing wrongs are annoying, right? Because in our world, our game here, right, they come out and they say all these outrageous things. Is that group influential? No, they're not really. You know, they piss people off in the industry, but with all the lies and stuff they tell. But they're, you know, they've got a tiny, tiny little budget. They, you know, you see them, I see them out front too, and you're walking into up in Saratoga, you're walking into the track. But the focus of effort should be at looking at larger groups. Right now, looking at PETA, I'm just very the Edie Falco thing made me very suspicious about what's coming from them. And again, it's having conversations, you know, with key players in the industry about, you know, how can we respond to this stuff. So it's, you know, we mentioned Alan Foreman before, and you know, Alan is a great medium, right? He's on our show all the time. And he's, you know, he's a real pro at this stuff, you know. You know, you can get Pat McKenna up at NYRA, the communications head at NYRA. And, you know, Pat's a very, very skilled guy, or down to NTRA, or, you know, folks at the Jockey Club, right. Any of this. But, you know, some conversations on how can we be ready to go out if we get a full-on onslaught here is just prudent. But the other issue here is the media that are covering this, right? You know, the Times Union is now highlighted because they've been doing this series. And listen, I've been dealing with journalists since I wrote my first press release from my father's restaurant when I was 16 years old, right? And it's kind of, he always thought, you know, it's weird you ended up in that business, David. But listen, my opinion of journalists, I respect journalists, right? I respect the profession of journalists. I do not think that there are huge left-wing or right-wing conspiracies out there on this. I think there's certainly some bias on certain issues, but you kind of got to understand what they're doing. When you get a local newspaper like the Times Union, and we've seen a tremendous contraction of local news over the last 20 years. And, you know, more recently we see this big private equity firms coming up and just gobbling up tons of newspapers, cutting costs. Their news gathering resources are very much diminished. So when you get somebody like the Times Union coming out with a series like this, in the end, in all news, you're looking for eyeballs, right? On the TV screen or on the newspaper. The best way to get eyeballs is to kind of elicit an emotional response from people. You couple that, got to get eyeballs, you know, we want to say things that are controversial, and you overlay it with the fact that the Times Union thinks they are the premier, you know, newspaper covering horse racing in the country, something that the Louisville Courier Journal would probably disagree with on this. But that is certainly a mindset there. So I believe it's a mindset there. So doing something that's going to stimulate, you know, controversy is, you can understand why it happens, right? But I think we've got to do a better job when reporting like this is going on of as an industry of engaging in it, so you can help shape the stories. I tell clients, frequently when you're in a bad situation with things, that by going in and engaging, if you've got a story that's going to be a graded a D and you can move it to a C, right? You know, that's good. That's progress. The goal is always to get a higher grade on this. But if you're not actively engaging on stories, you don't have the opportunity to shape those stories, and at least you may not make them something you like, but you're going to make something you hate less. Right?
There is, of course, the fairly new, you mentioned Pat, and he's been a big part of this We Are New York Horse Racing team, which actually goes beyond racing interests and breeders, etc. It brings in a wide variety from all over the state of business concerns, unions, and more. And this feels like an effort that that can beat a drum very consistently. You know, with an audience, they have a commercial that's running too at the same time as this new PETA ad. It is messaging in this regard. David Fuskus with us, and David has consulted with Jockey Club and his public relations and crisis management firm Xenophon Strategies. Is a quiet message designed to offset the propaganda? The propaganda is laden with sensationalism and with horrific imagery. What's your view of trying to counter that with statistics and employment numbers and revenue streams and the reality that this is that this is an industry that employs tens of thousands and is a economic driver. How you would think that resonates more so than
in the modern world, Steve, and today when you and I and everybody listening to the show, we are bombarded with so much information, and every one of us, we've all become on our own little editors, right? You get your phone out there, you pick the things you look for, you set these issues on alerts, you got a big force field bubble around you, and you choose, what to let in there, right? And it is easier to get something through somebody's, information force field like that, if it stimulates an emotional response with you, makes you outraged or makes you sad or makes you happy on this. So when you're going out and you don't pay attention to the facts, or you go out and put your version of facts on a narrative out there using bits and pieces, like I've mentioned earlier in our conversations, it's easier to do, right? So when we're going out and saying things like the facts so it's not so much about horse deaths now, that still happens, of course, and that's terrible, but look at the progress that's being made. Look at the progress we hope to improve on that once the anti-doping section of the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is up and running next, January 1st. But the way you make those things is going in, and it's not so much coming out with that to counter this article out here, although we want to try and do that, but it's an ongoing dialogue with journalists on facts and keeping them educated and well educated on things. And they may choose to ignore them, but it really works on that. And you know, and the things that the effort that Pat McKenna is leading is, you know, I mean, it's absolutely correct, right? And you know, going out with a media buy, you know, when I first heard about it, we got a media buyout and it's a, you know, it's on Twitter or Facebook or, you know, something. But no, it turns out it's a broadcast media buy, which reaches a lot more people. You know, kind of a tip of the hat for that, that they're out, you know, spending money on that. But that's, you know, all part of the mosaic of communications that you have to have to kind of fight against this stuff. It's, when you're in a fight like this, it really is a fight, right? It's a battlefield. Forward, you fall back, you get through, and the idea is to kind of, you know, win in the end. And you know, a key part of this is calling them on their BS, right? Like you or I or anybody, you read the Battelle article or this E.B. Falco thing that we've been talking about, and you go and like, how can they say that? You know, how can they say that? But you got to call them on their BS, right? And there's any number of ways to do that, but see, my overall point on this is to you know, make headway in the court of public opinion on things. There needs to be, you know, constant effort, right? And I'm not talking about a, you know, $10 million PR campaign. What I'm talking about is that these issues are up at the top of the focus and top of the priorities of the various, you know, groups out there that can make a difference on this stuff. You know, I mean, clearly, is it NYRA? You know, Pat's my opinion, Pat's the, you know, best guy in communications in the whole industry is out there, but he's good. And so, you know, they have to prioritize these things, not just react, right? Because when something happens and you're just in reaction mode, much easier to shape an issue if you're doing it before things break.
What vehicle, you mentioned the media buys, and that's high profile, you know, to a certain degree. But, you know, to pull a page from the, you know, all politics is local concept, would the industry benefit from disseminating a central materials that each individual racetrack organization and various state agencies that, you know, that are, you know, breeding support funds, you know, those kinds of things, keep, you know, keep in Kentucky. It feels like playing small ball here in winning hearts and minds. Is the right way to go. I mean, much like we've widened the reach of horse ownership through the partnerships, that's a ground level word of mouth, friends and neighbors scenario. It feels like, you know, this is something that anybody that's involved in the game, if provided there's some leadership and some tools given to them and put in their hands, that we could all affect, you know, very positively to make sure that the message, you know, is disseminated.
You know, it's one thing that doesn't work particularly well in situations like this is to come up with a set of talking points and shipping it out to everybody and have them read it, you know, verbatim. But what does work well is that when issues come up, you're supplying people with, you know, here's the take on the narrative. So if it's, you know, the PETA things come out, it's here's what E.D. Falco is wrong about. Here's what they did on this. And something like that's actually pretty easy to put together on a regular, you know, basis and disseminate out to people, as long as you identify in advance you know, who do we need to have it in? Who do we need to have, you know, this stuff? Whose hands do we need to have this stuff, to have this stuff in, as opposed to just kind of blasting it out, right? I mean, you can, you know, for example, you can send it out to every trainer in the world, and that's fine, right? But there are trainers who are out in the media more and are more comfortable, you know, engaging on issues other than just, you know, this particular you know, race. And you know, I remember going through, we were doing all the work in the Horse Racing Integrity Act, you know, Gary Contessa in New York came out. He was very willing to go out and talk about this stuff, and you know, horse health and drugs and all of this. And we weren't so much supplying him with go say these exact words, but here's the issues you need to talk about. You put it in your own words. It can be frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, say the least.
These issues, and you know, and it takes time, and it really takes an ongoing effort. But at the same time, you know, I say this doesn't have to be a $10 million, you know, program. If Jim Gagliano at the jockey club's listening right now, he's probably laughing. Jim, I'm not trying to get work here. but setting up a cooperative venture, you know, with NIRO, with various organizations, you know, certainly have the horsemen as well, where you're going out and you're paying attention to this, and you're coming out with materials, and you identified, you know, people who can talk in the media, maybe give them some media training so they can do a better job of it, and then you offer that stuff up as resources to journalists. So that's gonna help a lot. It really is. Yeah. And we haven't even talked about social media. Right.
Right.
So social media works best, right, when things are out there, when there is an issue around which people are passionate, right? If somebody's passionate about anything, they're much more likely to engage in it. And let's face it, on our side of this thing for the game, there's a lot of people that are passionate about this, right? I mean, you know tons. I know tons. Just if you go online on things. I mean, just that little thing I put in I published in the Pollock report, and I can't tell you the number of texts and direct messages and emails I got on that about people who, you know, for the very passionate about this, and tapping into the passion on social media, you get a little social media army going. It's, you know, it's very, you know, it's, it can be very effective. One of the things that during the whole fight for the, you know, Horse Racing and Integrity Act, when we were working for the, you know, the pro ISA forces and the jockey club on it, one of the things that was really effective was we managed to go out and build a group of about 55,000 people who were passionate about two things. They're passionate about horse races, or they're passionate about horses, right? And actually, the people who are passionate about horses were the larger part of that group. But educating them, getting them to, you know, contact legislators, getting them to, you know, engage in social media. I mean, we built and had a whole army there, and it was, it worked quite effectively. But there's no reason that can't be done in a more organized fashion in the racing business.
Well, and again, it feels like there's got to be a central body disseminating, you know, that kind of information and you know, some of those talking point, bullet point communication sheets that we see, you know, showing how one horse leads to X amount of jobs and X amount of X amount of economic trickle down, etc.
It always comes, you know, in anything you're doing, you want to look at things that are in the realm of the possible. Is this possible to do this? Yeah, certainly it's possible to do it. And then what's the structure that makes it most likely to happen? And, you know, it's probably not going and trying to create a new organization. I know you weren't suggesting that, but, or, you know, it certainly wouldn't work if you're going to plop it with the Breeders' Cup or the Jockey Club or the HBPA or whatever that. But to put together a, you know, small coordinating, you know, body on this to go in and work out, okay, that we're going to have some general communications on this. There's the people that we're going to recruit into doing that. There's the people we're going to stand up across the country that can be media sources. And then with all of our organizations, we're going to use all of our organizations, our communications resources, our social media audiences, interactions with journalists. That'd be a good start. And that's doable. Right.
Yeah.
That's doable.
Yeah.
Especially because something like that, you're not going out, you know, a lot of things comes back to money, right? Oh, we're going to go start this. We need blah, 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 you know, X number of dollars. Something like this isn't money. It's not the group's giving money, at least to start out on it. It's them, you know, using some of their resources. And the one factor that would make all of that work is a prioritization of the leadership of various organizations, say this is a priority for this, and we want our organization to be involved in it.
David Fuskus been with us, Xenophon Strategies, and has consulted with Jockey Club on crisis management and communication. Long overdue. I really appreciate it. We'll get you back. We'll get you back as well.
Okay, Steve. As I said, I'm a big fan, and. And I'll see you at Saratoga this summer, because for me, just like tons and tons of people, once the first race goes off at Saratoga, I'm there and I'm happy.
Well, exactly. A bad day at the track is better than a good day at work, and that's universally true. I do want to finish as we wrap. David's organization is working directly and helping World Central Kitchen and Andres, who is one of the most remarkable individuals in the world, and shows up wherever there's crises and just feeding people and helping. So
the situation in the Ukraine. They've been there since about day three after the invasion. You go to charity, they're feeding people, which is what they do. You go to Charity Navigator and you're like, well, they've got a perfect 100% score. So your money's going to a good place. And, we just hired here a new employee, just started this week, but he's from Ukrainian. He's from Lviv. So when he was here, when we first got here, I was talking to him. I said, "Have you ever heard of this group, World Central Kitchen?" And he goes, "They're everywhere. They're so good." That just made me, so happy. But if you're looking for a way to directly help people, help the refugees, World Central Kitchen is a great place for your money, and it, doesn't go to overhead and all that stuff. It goes to help people. It's just a wonderful organization.
WCK.org on that front, or at David's website, Xenophon Strategies. David Fuskus, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you. I enjoyed it.
We'll have you back. David Fuskus, everybody. And just got about a second to wrap up. I promised you Gus, and we'll have maybe 15 seconds for his Masters play. And as soon as we get him, Gus, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
Very good. You got about 30 seconds. What do you suggest people that want to play the Masters?
Masters, it's pretty wide open, I think, this year. You got a lot of, first-time starters going in that have a shot. And the one I'm focusing on the most is a multiple winner. It's Sam Burns. I think you could get him right around 50-1. He's a multiple winner. He's a kid out of LSU, strong, drives the ball well. If he gets that putter going, I think he's going to be there. Top 10 is a very solid bet, but I'm also going to take him top five and to win as well.
Look at you. Good job. Gus, we'll get you back on Friday with some opinions on the weekend.
Sounds great. What a sports weekend.
Big time. Gus Alonso, everybody. Bogey, 1967, and I wanted to get that in for those of you that are going to play Masters. Thanks to Gus. Thanks to David Fuskas. We'll get Seth in tomorrow. Trey Stiles, Sid Fernando, Kevin Kirstein, and Dick Powell. Good luck today if you're playing, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning. Learn more at countrylifefarm.com.
The PA Horse Breeders Association introduces the Pennsylvania Stallion Series. Four brand new races to be run at parks for PA-sired, PA-bred two-year-olds. There are two $100,000 contests on August 22nd. PA Day of the Races. September 24th, PA Derby Day, has two more races, each with a $200,000 purse. The PA Stallion Series. Yet another reason why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race. For more, please visit PABred.com.
Your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.